In the 1970s, the Chinese government observed what was happening in the Soviet Union and found that the attempts to reform the Soviet economy, the Kosygin reforms, were not working. That what the Chinese understood is that the Soviets, although they developed incredibly in terms of technology and science, were not able to develop their productivity to be competitive with capitalism. You got to trounce capitalism on productivity. Socialist productivity should be at a better level than capitalist productivity. That doesn't mean that the rate of exploitation needs to increase, but that you need to be able to improve the kinds of machines that you have in your factories and so on. You don't exploit the workers more in terms of physical capacity, but the rate of production can increase without the rate of exploitation of workers. That was what the Chinese started to debate and discuss. Same debate takes place in Cuba in the 1960s. Helen Yaffe's book is excellent on this, on the economic planning in Cuba, the thinking of Che Guevara and so on. Well, in China, they decided that they better learn quickly from Japan, Singapore and so on. So they started going on a tour of these countries to learn what did they do, what are they doing. It's very interesting what the Chinese did. They understood that if they relied on endogamous or internal science and technology development, it would take them too long. So they welcomed foreign capital to come into China and set up factories. This is the reform era. To set up factories as long as they transferred technology during the setting up of the factory process. All these French companies were dying to come to China because Chinese labor were a much better quality than labor anywhere else in the world, because they were better educated, better fed, had better health care, and so on. You know, if you look at sick days between India and China, it's extraordinary. Indian workers, because of low nutrition, poor health care, long commutes and so on, have many more sick days. You know, lack of clean water, for instance, increases the number of sick days. You get all kinds of intestinal problems and so on. You can't be on the job for long enough. Anyway, these French companies, German companies, then later US companies come in and they transfer technology to the Chinese. What the Chinese do is really interesting. They understood that technology is yesterday's science, that the latest developments in science will be tomorrow's technology. It wasn't enough just to mirror the technology coming in. They had to figure out how to make the next generation and the next generation of technology. Every time I visited these Chinese universities and talked to people who are in the science and tech area, they always say we're thinking about XYZ 20 years, 50 years from now, not now. We're not thinking about building the best cell phone for the present. We're thinking about how do we build a cell phone that's going to help a rural community develop a better understanding of, for instance, transportation networks. I mean, they are thinking of technology as part of their social infrastructure. Outside Beijing, when they decided the capital of the country, 21 million people, was just too big, environmental problems too grave, traffic problems too grave, the Chinese decided to build a city outside Beijing, 5 million people, entirely carbon emissions neutral city. It's just an incredible place. There was an enormous lake, totally polluted, which they've cleaned up. You can build the productive forces in such a way that are not detrimental to the social development of your population. That has been now proven to us by the Chinese. That doesn't mean that they've solved all the problems and they've created socialism. But they are thinking about, always thinking about, how do we advance the productive forces without harming society? Now it's interesting, zigs and zags. Tell you quite honestly, I've been going to China for years. And in 2012, I thought, man, this is on the edge of destruction. Because the society seems completely captivated by the big billionaires, you know, the Jack Ma's and so on. And then we started hearing that in Chongqing, for instance, Bo Xilai had started this red cultural thing where they started doing celebrations of, you know, the history of the Communist Party and so on in public, which hadn't happened in a long time. Well, Bo Xilai got into trouble eventually, and that's another story. The arrival of Xi Jinping to power was interesting, because I think Xi Jinping recognized early on, and not just Xi Jinping, but the section that he represents in the Communist Party, that things had zagged too far. That even under Hu Jintao, who was a pretty sincere person, there was too much of a rise of inequality. And that the billionaires were a little too happy and pleased with where they were. Corruption had increased and so on. And then you got this deep zag from Xi Jinping. This really sharp left turn where they started to essentially put the billionaires in their place. I mean, Jack Ma was effectively sent to go and study the collected works of Xi Jinping and Mao Zedong. And he disappeared from public view for a long while, studying texts. If you look recently, there was a report in China that showed that the number of billionaires has collapsed. They've basically gone after them and said, we really, you know, your presence is no longer required. You can still stay in the country, but I don't think you need to be that rich. And we're going to take some of your wealth and socialize it. So this is the zig and zag. But what's interesting is they are also experimenting with trying to build productive forces at the same time as you're socializing the means of production. There is no way to do this without creating problems. I mean, you know, that's the reason why the theory of contradictions is so important in historical development. There is no way to manage these three contradictions. The first, building the productive forces in a very poor country. The second, socializing the means of production, increasing the social development of people. And the third, defending yourself from imperialist attack. You can't do these three things simultaneously without always, always making enormous mistakes and errors of judgment one way or the other. Now the issue is, and I'm going to wind things up with this, the issue is what Fidel Castro said in his 1961 speech to the intellectuals in Cuba. I don't know if any of you read this text. It's widely available. I think it's available on the web in several languages. 1961, in Cuba, in 59, the revolution takes place. And then Fidel and the communists do, I think, what most people didn't expect them to do, which is very unusual for people who come into office. In 1953, Fidel was arrested after the attempt on 26th of July at the Moncada base and other bases around the country. It was the uprising of 53. He was arrested. And you know, governments do stupid things. Like, it was really stupid for the government of Andres...
Fulgencio Batista.
Not Batista. I'm thinking about 1992 in Venezuela. Okay. Andres, whatever, the president of Venezuela in 92. It was really stupid of him to put Hugo Chavez on national TV in 92. Because I don't know if you remember this, but Chavez had attempted a coup in 92 against the government. And then they put him on TV, and this extraordinarily charismatic man, I mean, extraordinarily charismatic, goes on national TV. And he does two things which nobody ever do. He first takes responsibility for the whole uprising, tells people to stop their mutiny, because it was a military mutiny largely, and he says, I am to blame. And in Venezuela, entire generations have never seen a political leader say that they are to blame. That had never been heard by anybody. It was like, what? He's saying he's responsible? Extraordinary. Everybody always says somebody else is responsible. But he said, I'm responsible. And then he said, everybody stop trying to overthrow the government. Stop por ahora. What a great thing to say. For now. That slogan, for now, becomes his election campaign in 1998. Stupid to put Chavez on TV. Well, the government in Cuba, equally stupid, put Castro on trial in 1953. Stupid decision. You know, if you pick up a revolutionary, don't let them speak in public. Lock them away. It's a dumb thing to do. Put Castro in a courtroom. He was a trained lawyer. Of course Castro spoke for a long time. Because that's what the old man did. He spoke for a long time. He sat in that courtroom impeccably prepared, and he laid out the agenda of the Cuban Revolution. If you haven't read that text, which you can find called History Will Absolve Me, I really recommend you read it tonight. Have a few drinks, go back, think of Castro, boil some Moringa tea, and read History Will Absolve Me. In that text, in that speech, Castro lays out, he says, this is what we will do when we come to power. We'll do this, we'll do this, we'll do this, we'll do this. 1959, they come to power, and he follows exactly what he said in 1953. He says, for instance, why should the Cuban people pay electricity rates to an American electric company that are higher than the rates paid by people in the United States? So we are going to nationalize the electric company. Perfectly reasonable statement. It's not even revolutionary. It just makes sense. It's common sense. Why is a company that sells energy cheaper in the United States selling it for higher in Cuba? Ridiculous. We're going to change that. Then he says, we sell sugarcane to these companies. These companies haven't paid us X amount of the profit from the sugarcane. Okay, you're entitled to some profit, but half of that profit we want back. Perfectly commonsensical claim. Like, I could walk today to Rio Tinto, march into the office, ring the bell, let them see me, go up to the chairman's office and say, the people of West Papua, the people of the Congo, and so on, would like to take over your building. On behalf of them, I am commandeering your building. That's exactly what Castro said to the properties of the big companies in Cuba. He said, you owe us X amount of US dollars. You can pay the US dollars into the exchequer. If you don't, we're taking over your properties. He didn't seize the property, by the way. This is total propaganda. Castro didn't go and just grab the property. He said, you owe us money. If you're not going to pay it, we're going to repossess assets. This is a perfectly commonsensical thing that capitalists do all the time, right? When you bought your sports car, were driving it around, couldn't pay the thing, they send the repossession agents to take it away. All that the Cuban government did was repossess the profits that were stolen from them. So Castro was doing all these things, perfectly fine. There was a section of people who started criticizing the government. There were some who criticized the government to the point of saying, we think it should be overthrown. They arrested them. It should also be said that they did arrest people who committed grave crimes, and they, of course, received the judgment they deserved. Castro decided, when the criticism started rising, particularly from certain artists and intellectuals, he called them into the National Theater in Havana, and he gave a speech. First, he listened to a lot of the criticisms. It's very interesting the way we read texts. We read, for instance, Mao Zedong's great text on Yan'an, you know, the text on art and culture. And what we don't know about that text is that there was like a 2 or 3 day conclave in the caves of Yan'an where artists from across the revolutionary spectrum, artists, writers, and others, came and discussed the problems of building socialist art. Mao Zedong came to all those lectures and discussions, took lots of notes, and then came back on the last day and gave his reflections on the debates around art and culture at Yan'an, but we read that as if it's just Mao's ideas. It's Mao absorbing what he had learned from the writers' cultures, systematizing it, and producing a kind of theory of art. In the same way, Castro listens to everybody, they have their objections, they speak, and so on. And then he stands up and he responds. And that speech is beautiful, the 1961 speech to artists and intellectuals. What Castro said is, and this formula applies even for us today, not only to revolutions that are going on now, such as in Burkina Faso and so on, but also to how we understand 1917. It applies to us today. What Castro said is, you can criticize the Cuban Revolution if your criticism is aimed to make it better. If your criticism is within the revolution, that's how he phrased it. If your criticism is within the revolution, it's welcome. If you want to make the revolution better, you are welcome to make any criticism. You are welcome to make any criticism. That is criticism within the revolution. But then he said, if your criticism is outside the revolution, it is not welcome. You can take it elsewhere. What did he mean by outside the revolution? If your criticism is intended to weaken the revolution, to overthrow the revolution, to join hands with the imperialist attack on the revolution, then we don't welcome it. This seems to be a pretty decent formula for our understanding of contemporary revolutions and old revolutions. When we assess them, we should never be romantic, dewy-eyed romantic. I don't look back at the Russian Revolution and say everything they did was correct. Enormous errors were made. Enormous errors were made because the revolution was built by people, people like us, not by titans who are 12 times our size. Lenin was just like us. A few years ago, I was stunned to realize that Lenin died and I was older than him. He died at age 56. When I turned 57, I was like, wow, I'm a year older than Lenin. You know, a year, that was stunning to me. Yeah? He died at 56. Franz Fanon died at 36. I mean, these people died really young. Sankara in his 30s. Lumumba in his 30s. Killed all of them. Yeah? So young. They are not titans, you know, huge giants who roamed the earth. They are not geniuses. They were representatives of people's movements. They were produced by those movements. Amilcar Cabral, produced by the movement. Ho Chi Minh, produced by the movement. Something was extraordinary in them, but they were also a product of the movement. They were people, they made mistakes. Mao Zedong made so many mistakes. He recognized it as well. You don't need a biography that attacks him. He recognized his own mistakes. Some he didn't recognize, human being, like all human beings. You know, you're blinded by your own abilities and so on. They were all made by people. We judge them for what they tried to do. We do what we want to do based on the experiences that they have left us. We want to build a revolution. We don't want to live in a society where big mining companies, big weapons companies set the agenda. We want to build a society. We want people to be able to live to the fullness of their potential. We know that they can't live to the fullness of their potential in this. We know that a miner who's mining for wealth, which produces a company like BHP, that miner will never have more than lung cancer and an early death. We know that the people who make armaments, who are grinding the bombs, they have as short a life, maybe, as the people who are going to face the wrath of those bombs, while the weapons dealers have giant yachts and enjoy their lives till perpetuity. We know that. We know that this cannot go on forever. We know that if we do make a revolution, we will learn from the wisdom of the revolutions of the past. I hope we will learn. But I also know we'll make our own mistakes. I also know that we will zig and zag. I also know that we will get attacked by the imperialists that remain. But I know that that doesn't stop us from trying. That cannot stop us from trying. We may be few, but we represent many. And we will become many. Thanks a lot. Okay.